Support for WPR comes from WIPS with Toward One Wisconsin, a conference on equity, diversity, and inclusion, May 7th and 8th in Eau Claire. Registration information and more is at t1w.org.
Support for WPR comes from the American Society of Landscape Architects Wisconsin chapter. Dedicated to reimagining the design of outdoor spaces for the well-being of all. Examples at wiasla.com.
It's 5:06. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, we'll talk about why the mosquitoes have been so bad so early this season.
Last week, the NCAA and the U.S. Department of Defense announced a new initiative aimed at getting a better understanding of how sports-related concussions affect the brain and how to determine if an athlete is ready to return to the game.
The $30 million study will include the creation of a big database that researchers hope will offer new insight on possible links between head injuries and longer-term brain damage.
The Medical College of Wisconsin in Milwaukee will be the home base for the Advanced Research Corps. Here to talk about the initiative is Michael McCray, professor of neurosurgery and director of brain injury research at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Michael, welcome to Central Time.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Well, you've been at the forefront of concussion research for about two decades now. What is your number one priority as far as this new initiative and as it gets off the ground?
I think as it relates to the Advanced Research Corps for this new initiative, it takes us into entirely new space in our scientific understanding of concussion. Over the last 20 years or so, our group and other groups around the country have conducted several large-scale studies that have informed our understanding of clinical recovery time after concussion in terms of how long it typically takes for an athlete to achieve complete recovery in terms of their symptoms, their cognitive functioning, and other functional abilities after injury. And historically, we've relied on those metrics to make decisions about an athlete's fitness to return to play. The burning question, however, over the years has been more along the lines of how long does it take for recovery to occur at a brain level, physiologically and neurobiologically. And that's what the ARC, the Advanced Research Corps studies for this new initiative will undertake. We're going to be utilizing head impact sensors that tell us about the frequency and magnitude of head impacts that athletes sustain during participation. And then injured athletes will be undergoing very detailed assessments using MRI scans and blood biomarkers, genetic testing, and otherwise that will inform now the time course of physiological recovery after sport-related concussion.
And it sounds like in the past it's been hard to get a real solid read on what we were dealing with when it came to concussions. Athletes wanted to get back into the game. They might downplay the extent of their injuries. And we just weren't sure how severe concussions were. Is it important now that we get some real solid data as we go forward?
Yes, I think one of the areas of speculation for years has been to the extent to which we could rely and depend on an athlete informing us about their true level of symptom recovery, knowing that they were and are highly motivated to return to their sporting activities as soon as they possibly can. And the movement over the years has been toward more objective measures, both diagnostically in terms of detecting injury, but more importantly, more objective measures that tell us about recovery and an athlete's fitness to return to play, rather than relying solely on their self-reported symptom recovery.
And one of the things that you'll be doing is fitting helmets with sensors and non-helmeted athletes with a different kind of sensor and getting a look at the impacts and how they register. What do you expect to learn from that?
There were really two lines of investigation as it relates to the head impact sensors. As you've stated, we'll have our helmeted athletes, for instance, football players, duly equipped with both a helmet-borne system and a small adhesive sensor that they wear behind their ear, which our non-helmeted athletes will also wear. And these sensors will be worn during all practices, all games. We've been conducting this type of work for quite some time now. But it allows us to really characterize and profile, number one, the frequency and severity of impacts that athletes sustain just through routine participation in contact and collision sports, aside from concussive injuries. And then secondly, we can really gain a much better understanding of the biomechanics of impacts that cause brain injury, which then have great value in future efforts toward injury prevention, equipment design, rule changes, et cetera, that would try to eliminate head impacts of that form of dynamic or magnitude in hopes of eliminating or reducing the and preventing the number of injuries that sometimes occur in sports.
Now, in the case of student athletes, you're looking at, you know, kids who might be 8 years old and athletes who might be in their 20s and 30s, but it often happens that you're looking at younger brains. Are younger brains more vulnerable to head injury than other brains?
More vulnerable, it's unclear. There have been reports in the literature that the younger brain takes longer to recover than the intermediate or older brain as it relates to sport-related concussion. But by longer, we're really talking about perhaps a period of a couple or a few days longer. You know, the important message that sometimes gets lost in the mix or the discussion and is critical to athletes and sports parents like myself is that sport-related concussion, in the overwhelming majority of cases, is followed by an uncomplicated pattern of recovery over a period of a week or so. And as long as the injury is appropriately managed and the athlete is conservatively monitored in terms of their return to play, most athletes return to participation without any bumps have no lingering problems. That said, we still need a more evidence-based approach as to how we return athletes to participation once they have achieved a complete clinical recovery. And that's what this initiative is intended to drive at.
And as far as getting that information that you need, one of the things you're going to be doing is doing extensive neuroimaging. What do you expect to learn from that?
We have the capabilities now with advances in MRI scanning to tell us not only about changes in brain structure resulting from injury, but also brain function. So, for instance, we will be utilizing what we refer to as a multimodal MRI scanning platform that tells us not only about changes in brain structure, which are frankly, very infrequent, resulting from minor injuries like concussion. But there are significant changes in the functional ability of the brain, including, for instance, patterns of normal connectivity across brain regions and the transmission of cellular activity at a biological and a physiological level. And these new scanning modalities allow us to, in real time, in human research participants, study the dynamic changes in brain function over the course of recovery after concussion. And we'll be scanning, for instance, athletes at multiple time points post-injury and comparing those scans to those of non-injured athletes to better inform how long it takes for brain connectivity, for instance, to return to normality after injury as an indicator of recovery.
And you mentioned biomarkers as well. How does that factor in?
Yeah, we will be studying, in addition to the MRI scanning, we'll be drawing blood samples on these athletes prior to the start of the season, and then for any injured athletes and control subjects, we'll be drawing specimens again at several time points post-injury to see how some of the emerging, what we refer to as blood biomarkers, blood enzymes and other agents that are susceptible to change in light of head injury or other trauma. And similar to the MRI example, we'll be looking to find those those abnormalities as a diagnostic marker of injury during the earliest acute window. We'll be drawing these athletes within hours of their injury. And then ultimately the exercise is to determine at what point do those blood biomarkers return to normal levels as an indicator of physiological recovery, much like we're doing with the MRI scanning.
We're talking right now about a new initiative announced last week, hoping to provide researchers a better understanding of the link between concussions and brain damage. Our guest is Michael McCray, professor of neurosurgery and director of brain injury research at the Medical College of Wisconsin. And we invite you to join the conversation. Have you suffered from a sports-related brain injury? Did you notice impacts on your health or brain function as a result? And what more are you hoping researchers will come away with as they get started on this new initiative? Let us know at 800-642-1234. We're talking about sports-related concussions and new initiatives aimed at understanding how they relate to brain damage. Our guest is Michael McCray, professor of neurosurgery and director of brain injury research at the Medical College of Wisconsin, where most of the core research will be taking place. And we invite you to join our conversation. Have you suffered from a sports-related brain injury? What kind of symptoms did you notice? What was the result of that brain injury? How did it resolve itself? And what do you want researchers to know if you let your child play a sport with a risk of concussion? Let us know, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at talk@wpr.org. We're going to go to our phones now and take a call from Chris in Madison. Hi, Chris.
Hey, how's it going?
Pretty good.
All right. Well, I've been playing high-impact sports, football and rugby, for the last 14 years. And I guess one of the major changes I've noticed over the last, over that time period is just the cultural changes that have come across through concussions and concussion management. When I first started playing football, it was sort of you get hit in the head and you got your bell rung, get back out there and go, keep playing. It was kind of like playing hurt through a sprained ankle. And nowadays it's more of a, it's not worth it. You know, you got, your head's hurting, or do you have a concussion? Is it worth going back out and playing? And I hope that these type of, these studies and these initiatives, continue that trend.
All right. Interesting, Chris. So Chris has seen already some changes in the way that we treat people who may have concussions, that it's more important to take care of your health. Do you think this study and this research will further that kind of cultural shift?
No question. I think Chris raises perhaps one of the most important points that has developed from all of the research over the last 20 years. And as simple as it may sound, perhaps the most monumental public health change we made over the past decade is at all competitive levels, it is prohibited for any athlete to return to participation on the same day as they sustain a concussion. Now, that may seem as just basic common sense and good care, but as he pointed out, that was not the culture prior to, for instance, 5 or 10 years ago, where it was quite commonplace at all competitive levels, from youth to high school, college, and professional, for athletes, some of whom were even rendered unconscious, to return to participation in the same contest on the same day. And finally, the Zurich panel that I was on in 2008 and 2012, we sent a strong recommendation that should be prohibited at all competitive levels. But I think to Chris's point, society and sports parents and sport governing bodies are really looking to the science now for the answers to the pressing questions. But at the same time, we can't lose track of the fact that this will require a cultural shift. And some believe that the pendulum may have swung too far, and we'll eventually come back to the middle based on the science itself.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your call and your comments, Chris. And we're going to move now to Jenny in Racine. Hi, Jenny.
Hi. How are you?
Good, thanks. What do you think about concussions?
Well, I have two questions, and I only told your screener one of them. But one of them is, how does ADD or ADHD affect recovery or affect concussion? And secondly, how do concussions that occur from a car accident like I had last week, and how's the recovery process with that? I was physically active and I still have symptoms, a week later. I can't go back to exercise or activity yet. How are the recoveries different from sport versus other concussions?
Okay, Jenny, thanks for that question, and both questions, actually. What do you think, Michael?
With regard to your second question, the overwhelming body of literature on concussion in civilians from car accidents and falls and other mechanisms is actually very similar to what we see in the sports literature, with the caveat that assuming that indeed it was a concussion and had no abnormal imaging on CT scanning and so forth, that the lion's share of individuals make a complete recovery within a matter of several days and then gradually return to their normal activities. Now, I think you mentioned that your injury was a week ago. There's no question that after a concussion, people feel really lousy for a few days, and then they gradually begin resuming their normal activity. You're right that you should not be out under heavy physical exertion at this point in your recovery, but it is completely realistic for you to start gradually resuming your normal physical activities. And I would predict, I don't have any knowledge of your injury, obviously, but again, the overwhelming majority of individuals make a complete recovery in a matter of several days and some upwards to a couple weeks after their injury, as long as there aren't other complicating factors. And forgive me, but your first question, remind me?
Does ADHD affect concussions and recovery?
So it's been a bit of a mixed bag in the scientific literature as to how ADHD affects one's risk and recovery. There have been some studies indicating that athletes who have a history of ADHD are at a slightly elevated risk of concussion. It's unclear as to whether or not that's because of some vulnerability physiologically to do with their condition or whether it's something about the way they play the sport, both of which are viable possibilities. But at a everyday practical level, it is good, for instance, for athletic trainers and coaches and so forth to know when young athletes have ADHD, learning disability, or any other vulnerabilities, because that's something that you want to take into consideration when you're monitoring and assessing an athlete's level of recovery and their fitness to return to participation.
All right. Thank you, Jenny, for those questions. And I want to follow up on something you said earlier, Michael. You said that some people think that the pendulum has swung too far, which I gather take to mean that some people think we're being too cautious about concussions now, that maybe there's too much alarm in the wake of lawsuits, you know, with the NFL and the NHL and worries about kids getting concussions in sports. Is that something that you're thinking about as you do this research, that maybe we've overcorrected?
Yes. In so many words, yes. There's some thought out there that the story has, for instance, raced out in front of the science. And I can tell you, for instance, in my own situation, the anthropology of this has been quite fascinating in that when I would go to a cocktail party 10 years ago and people would ask what I do, there was a lot of curiosity about, wow, I didn't realize that concussions were really worthy of research. Does it happen that often? And what's the big deal? And now the discussion has changed dramatically in that the first question those people at cocktail parties have for me is, why would anyone ever want to play contact and collision sports given the risks? And I say, well, let's let the science answer those questions, because the risks probably aren't as significant as maybe how they've been positioned in certain storylines. And I can tell you that certainly this is, in a matter of 10 short years, this has gone from not being on anybody's radar, especially sport parents, to being on everybody's radar and maybe with their antenna way up, a bit hypervigilant about the about this injury and its and its potential consequences. There's no question it's a very common injury in contact and collision sports, and is a serious injury that is worthy of attention. But the reality is every kid that bumps his or her head does not necessarily end up with a concussion.
And, Michael, in our last 20, 30 seconds here, if there's a student athlete or concussion patient who wants to get involved in the research, what should they do?
Well, they could certainly reach out to me and my staff here at the Medical College of Wisconsin. There is information on the Medical College of Wisconsin website about our brain injury research program. And I think that's probably the best way for anyone out there who's interested to get informed about the type of work we do here, not only with regard to sport-related concussion, but brain injury in civilians and military service members and other populations at risk.
Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking with Michael McCrae, professor of neurosurgery and director of brain injury research at the Medical College of Wisconsin. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's our weekly look at the latest news from Congress, from the controversial release of an American POW in Afghanistan to Senate candidate Joni Ernst, who's trying to make history as Iowa's first woman in Congress.
First, if you've been outside recently, chances are you were hit with an unpleasant realization. Mosquitoes are back, and this time they've returned in greater numbers than before.
Seems too early in the season to be dealing with our unofficial state bird, too early to me anyway. So why are we seeing, or so it seems, so many mosquitoes?
To explain what's behind the mosquito outbreak and what to expect in the coming months, we've got PJ Leash with us here in the studio. He's the manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. PJ, thanks for joining us today.
Sure, pleasure to be here.
Well, it seems like it's bad to me, but just how bad have the mosquitoes been so far this year?
Well, it really depends on where you are in the state. And certainly I was up in the northern half of the state Memorial Day weekend, and it seemed like it got to be Sunday afternoon and someone turned a switch on. All the mosquitoes seemed to have come out at once. So I've gotten several calls the past few days and last week about the northern part of the state, and it certainly sounds like they're having mosquitoes out in force.
Now, the hope this winter was that it's so cold, all the mosquito eggs will be frozen, and the mosquitoes will die, and we'll have no mosquitoes. It seems like the opposite happened. What happened? What weather conditions created this outbreak?
Well, we certainly did have an unusual winter. It was brutally cold, and a lot of people either thought or maybe hoped that insects like mosquitoes would have really been hit hard by the winter. Now, it depends on the mosquito species, but a lot of mosquitoes can actually spend the winter as eggs that are laid along bodies of water or in depressions out in the woods. And so those eggs would have been covered by snow. And in the state, we had pretty solid snow cover from parts of December into even parts of early May, depending on where you're located. And that solid snow cover really served as a good insulator. And so those eggs were protected. They didn't experience the same minus 20 degree temperatures that we did. Hmm. And so they were relatively warm under that snow, so to speak.
Well, mosquitoes, I'm sure, are food for lots of things, but we're the food for mosquitoes, so it's hard to be positive about that. But now it's spring, and we've got different weather conditions. It seemed like a slow spring, but then all of a sudden, boom, it's warm. I don't know. What happened this spring that contributed?
It was an interesting spring. And I joke that we almost skipped spring entirely and went right to summer because in parts of the state we had snow cover and ice cover on lakes very late. And then within the same month, actually within the span of about 3 weeks, we went from that snow cover to 80 degree temperatures. And I think with the mosquitoes, insects in general are cold blooded. And so whenever it gets warmer, their metabolism and physiology ramps up and they develop more quickly. And so I think that late snow break with a lot of snow melt and water, we've gotten a lot of rain lately, combined with warm temps, just caused a lot of mosquitoes to kind of come out all at once. And so it seems like this massive swarm just popped out of nowhere.
So you mentioned the northern part of the state being particularly bad. Is that where it's the worst, or is it going to be something that we're going to see in full force in all of Wisconsin?
Well, I'm curious to see myself. And in the Insect Diagnostic Lab, I do get calls in describing mosquito pressures from around the state. For the northern part of the state, it's really not uncommon to have these large mosquito populations. That just seems to be the norm. Now, the southern part of the state, I'm curious to see what we're going to get because we certainly have been getting a lot of rain lately. And at this point, it could indicate that we'll have strong mosquito numbers, but it's a little early to tell.
So there's hope, is what you're saying.
There is hope.
Of course, and the rain is good, too.
Yeah. Well, there's an interesting case. Certain mosquitoes breed in more permanent bodies of water. And so if we have water sitting around, the mosquitoes start to develop. If we get a large rainfall, an inch or two, in certain cases, that can actually flush the mosquitoes out of where they're developing, and they end up dying.
Is there an optimum number of mosquitoes, or is this a peak mosquito year?
That's definitely a good question. I mean, most people would say they'd be happy with no mosquitoes at all. From what I've been seeing so far, mosquitoes out in force, northern half of the state, but as I mentioned, it's really early to tell at this point what we're going to be seeing for the rest of the state this season.
But as a part of the ecosystem, we want some mosquitoes, right? Or things start breaking down.
Well, yes, mosquitoes can serve as food source for aquatic organisms, frogs, small fish, that sort of thing. So they do play an overall role in the ecosystem out there.
Now, in terms of, you know, the kind of mosquitoes, I always just assumed there's a mosquito. Is that true? Is there just a type of mosquito that's bothering everyone from the south to the north, or are there all different varieties?
There are all different types of mosquitoes in the state, and we actually have just over 50 different species of mosquito. They all have slightly different habits in terms of where they live, how they spend the winter, that sort of thing. What we're probably seeing in the northern half of the state at the moment are what we call some of our nuisance mosquitoes or floodwater mosquitoes. These are mosquitoes that rely on meltwater from snow or from flooding situations to develop, and they can be different from some of our mosquitoes that transmit diseases.
Now, one concern, of course, the West Nile virus, which has shown up for the past several years, been around for a while. Do we need to be concerned about that, especially this year?
Well, it's a little early to tell, and I have been checking some records. We do have two confirmed cases of birds positive for West Nile so far in the state, but it depends on what mosquitoes we're going to see. The mosquito that we most associate with West Nile, called Culex pipiens, tends to breed or develop in more permanent bodies of water, so shallow ponds or even containers. So if you had, say, an empty bucket in your yard that filled up with water, that's where that particular mosquito likes to breed. Now, those mosquitoes like to stay in that water for quite a while. And so if I mentioned earlier, if we get a lot of rainfall, it could even flush them out of the system. But when we get the large amount of rain, it's more of the floodwater mosquitoes, some of our more what we call nuisance mosquitoes that aren't associated with diseases like West Nile.
So obviously, if you're looking to avoid the threat of West Nile, you want to not be bitten by mosquitoes. To that end, what can we do? Is it just dousing yourself with bug repellent?
Well, insect repellent definitely is an important aspect of that to prevent mosquito bites. A couple other things you can do. If you can avoid being out in the evening or early at dawn, those are the periods when mosquitoes are most active. And so if you don't need to be out at that time of day, that's a good way to avoid mosquitoes altogether. If you are going to be out in the evening or early dawn hours, having on long sleeves, long pants, that'll help prevent mosquito bites as well.
Do you know anything about some of the new mosquito technology? I've seen things that you can wear on your wrist and they supposedly emit a blast of something that frightens the mosquitoes or repels the mosquitoes. Do things like that work? What works?
Well, when it comes down to what works, it seems like the mosquito repellent. They've been around a long time. They definitely work. There's all kinds of unusual devices out there. There are some sonic devices that produce sounds. Supposedly they mimic the sound of dragonflies or other predators, but we just haven't seen research data suggesting that they work and provide relief for mosquitoes. There are, I've heard of a few cases of wristbands that may have a DEET or some other repellent in them, so they may provide some relief. But when it comes down to it, treating either your skin or clothing with an insect repellent seems to be the main way to protect yourself.
Is that what you do when you're out in the field and you really don't want to get bitten?
That is what I do, yes.
All right, that's what the pros do. And what about a face net? Do you ever go that far? I mean, this is a bad year, at least up north.
Well, if you were a diehard fisherman and you wanted to be out, or just diehard outdoors person, you wanted to be out in the woods and the mosquitoes or black flies are bad, you know, a face net can keep them at bay.
All right. Well, PJ, thank you so much. And we'll be on the lookout and see what happens with these mosquitoes we're seeing.
Thank you.
Talking to PJ Leash, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab.
It's time for our weekly update on Congress with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. Last night, we saw primary results from Mississippi and Iowa.
Mississippi will go into a runoff election after a campaign with some significant drama, and Joni Ernst was hoping to make history in Iowa after taking the GOP Senate nomination. Iowa has never sent a woman to Congress.
And two controversies continue in Congress with the release of a prisoner of war, Sergeant Bo Bergdahl, and legislation aimed at addressing the VA scandal now facing the Senate. Paul Singer joins us each week at this time. Paul, welcome back.
Thanks very much. Good to be with you. How are you, Rob?
I'm doing good. How about you?
So far, so good.
Well, this release, Sergeant Bo Bergdahl, the White House exchanged five Taliban leaders, evidently detained at Guantanamo, for his release. Congress, many members of Congress, not happy about this. Would Congress usually play a role in this kind of deal?
Well, Congress is supposed to be briefed. They're not. I think part of the issue here is that Congress feels that they were kept in the dark. It's not necessarily that they would play a part in a deal like this, as it is that the administration is supposed to tell them that they're about to do it. In this case, it came as a surprise to everybody. And Democrats and Republicans both on Capitol Hill are saying, you know, we got no warning of this at all. It was a done deal before anybody told us. And in fact, even as we speak, a bunch of White House officials are heading up to Capitol Hill now to brief senators now on what we know about Bergdahl. There has been some question about exactly why he was captured in the first place. He was the only prisoner that we had in Afghanistan. And there is some suggestion that he essentially walked off his duty and was captured because he had more or less quit. Mm-hmm. And so there's a great deal of concern about both the nature of how he came to be captured and the nature of how this prisoner swap took place, particularly in the fact that the Americans have generally maintained that we do not negotiate with terrorists and we don't engage in prisoner swaps.
So how much of the anger from Congress has been kind of this breach of protocol, not informing Congress in advance, and how much of this has been criticism of the deal itself, the exchange itself?
You know, I think it starts with the concern, as always with Congress, it starts with the concern over their priorities, sorry, their prerogatives and their jurisdiction. They get mad when they don't get a proper protocol and they don't get briefed. Then you get the political element here of the question of, did we trade too much? Are we allowing these five Taliban guys to go back in the field and you know, re-engage the battle against Americans or against Afghans in the field? That becomes a legitimate debate. But then, of course, you have your political season going on here, so they want to blame Obama for handling it wrong or being having the wrong position on terrorism. It's hard sometimes to separate the legitimate concern about was this an appropriate transaction from the political opportunity to make a point to blame Obama for something bad.
Whether it's for those policy reasons or for political reasons, are we going to see panels, say, in the House run by Republicans looking into this deal?
Oh, yeah. Well, you'll definitely see a plenty of opportunity for oversight. The House is not going to create another special committee like they have on Benghazi, but they will definitely be having the House and even I think from the Senate are going to be having oversight hearings to look into how this trade went down. There's still some question about exactly was the country of Qatar serving simply as our did they come to us first, or were they serving as our missionaries here on this exchange? You know, I think people are very concerned that Americans did not reach out to the Taliban and say, "Well, let's make a deal."
And I know we can't read the administration's mind here. They've presented this as an oversight. Is it likely that it was an oversight that they didn't reach out to Congress first, or was this one of those act first, apologize later, you know, don't ask for permission first in a way situations?
Yeah, I honestly don't know, mm-hmm. Rob. I mean, it would not surprise me, given the political season that we're in, if the administration thought that it may not be to their advantage to talk to Congress first. On the other hand, I also think that they clearly underestimated the reaction. They were expecting a lot of praise for rescuing an American soldier. I think they underestimated, first of all, how much Congress would be concerned about the terms of this bargain, and then second of all, I think they really underestimated the concern about Bergdahl's background and whether he was really, you know, an upstanding member of the military. Now, I will tell you that USA Today had an editorial today, and I don't really usually read our editorials at all, by you know, for reasons of principle. I don't want to know what we think, but I will say that we had an interesting editorial today about this whole question of, you know, does Bergdahl's action matter? I mean, don't we have a commitment to our soldiers that we rescue them no matter what their sort of, you know, moral failings may have been? It's an interesting, I think, an interesting debate for us to have.
We'll keep watching that story. Another thing that came out this week that Congress has an interest in, new EPA regulations with the goal of cutting carbon emissions from power plants, mainly going to affect coal power plants by the year 2030. First, this is coming from the administration. Does Congress have a say in these regulations?
Well, you know, Congress has a say in these regulations because, to some degree, these are authorized by the Clean Air Act. I mean, there's been this long debate. Congress passed a law saying that EPA can regulate pollutants. And EPA said, well, then carbon should be a pollutant. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, they won in court. I mean, they're allowed to do this, right? So let's back up first. The Congress actually has had a role in this thing. They created the law that EPA is using to regulate this, first thing. Second thing, these regulations are not final. They've spent a lot of time taking comment and receiving feedback and redesigning the rules as they do in any rulemaking process. So Congress can be involved in that process as well. And third, Congress still does have a trigger mechanism, they don't use it very often, that they're allowed to basically veto rules that the agencies pass. That's going to be down the road a piece. We'll see where we are in a couple of years when these rules are you know, going to be final. You're not going to see a whole lot of activity, actual regulatory activity out of this process for quite a while. And sure, Congress is going to have hearings, and they're going to say, these are dumb rules, these are bad rules, they're bad for whatever. And then other people will say, no, this is good, this is important, it's going to drive a lot of innovation. I'll tell you, I covered the Clean Air Act 15 years ago, and it was supposed to bankrupt America, if you believed the detractors, and it hasn't. So who knows? Maybe over time we'll discover that these rules are not going to be quite as burdensome as they're currently made out to be.
Well, let's look at the political fallout. Say you had a hypothetical Senate race that looked like it might be a close one in a coal-producing state like Kentucky.
Exactly.
How's that going to affect that?
Well, I mean, I believe, and forgive me because it's been a long night, but I believe Allison Lundgren Grimes, the Democrat running in Kentucky, has already put out an ad today saying basically, send me to Congress so I can tell President Obama that his EPA regulations are stupid. This is the Democrat. Mm-hmm. Yeah? So there are a bunch of Democrats running away from these rules.
Well, hey, speaking of races for the Senate, a couple primaries yesterday, Mississippi and Iowa. Interesting Republican primary there in Mississippi. What happened there?
A six-term senator, the establishment senator Cochran from Mississippi, did not win his primary. Now, he didn't lose it either. Mm-hmm. He is stuck in a runoff against a Tea Party challenger named Chris McDaniel. This was a real bloody battle. They had at one point somebody who had supported McDaniel at some point went into the nursing home to take pictures of Cochran's bedridden wife. I mean, it got really ugly. Now the concern is it's three more weeks for this runoff of these two candidates slugging it out. The Republicans are concerned this is not going to be good for them at all. The Democrats nominated a guy, Travis Childers. He seems like a perfectly, non-controversial candidate amongst the Democrats, and he can just sit here and wait for this battle to play out for 3 weeks. That's going to be an advantage for the Democrats. Oh, now, whether they can ultimately win a statewide race in Mississippi seems, a bit of a stretch, but it's not good for the Republicans.
And Democrats are hoping that the Tea Party-affiliated challenger beats the long-term senator. They think they might have a better chance in that race.
Yeah, Yeah, and McDaniel at one point he was doing a lot of radio back in the day, talk radio, where he said a lot of fairly remarkable things and incendiary things. So there'd be plenty of fodder for a general election campaign.
And I think it was a 5-way Republican primary for the Senate race in Iowa. What do we know about the winner there?
The winner is most famous for a television ad called Squeal, where she pointed out that she grew up on a farm castrating hogs, so she knows how to go to Washington and cut the pork. She was able to unite the Tea Party and Sarah Palin behind her, as well as some of the establishment Republican groups like the Chamber of Commerce, and she just wiped up the floor with her opponents, and she is now in pretty good position to run against Congressman Bruce Braley, the Democrat. They're running to replace Tom Harkin, one of the liberal lions of the Senate, who has decided to retire. And the Democrats are really in danger of losing a seat here if Jody Ernst can carry this one off.
And it was, as we wrap it up, she'd be the first woman in Congress from Iowa?
Yeah. Go figure. Iowa's never elected a woman to Congress. So odd little factoid of history. But, yep, she'd be it.
Another race for us to watch between now and November. Paul, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Rob. Have a great day.
You too. That's Paul Singer. He's politics editor at USA Today. He joins us each Wednesday at this time to share the latest from the Capitol.